Good to be back with you for a fourth Sunday of thinking together about these themes in Christian spirituality. Maybe the I'm getting close.
Okay, can I share something real quick?
Oh, sure.
Since I once was almost an agnostic, I figured out finally the difference between an atheist and an agnostic.
Uh-huh.
The atheist is 100% certain there's no God. The agnostic is 99.9% certain there's no God. But there's 1% doubt that there might be.
Yes.
You agree with that?
Well, I haven't met a lot of, I mean, and I
don't want to hold you back.
Yeah, no, I suppose that, I mean, an atheist feels
it's
pretty
a
certain.
A little bit of humor in this.
Yes, right, exactly. We could use a little humor, I think. Good morning. It's great to be back with you for a fourth Sunday and final Sunday to think through some of these things. Sarah was just reminding me that my colleagues, Jerome Creech and Steve Toole, will be here for the next 4 weeks doing a biblical series on the law and the prophets. They know those things backwards and forwards. I suspect you've met them before. Steve is right now finishing up a commentary on some prophets or other. I don't remember which ones, but and you know they're delightful. So I just wanted to let you know that because what wonderful colleagues and presenters they are, and how nice that fall showed up. I was awfully happy about that, too. I hope you're all doing well this morning. Let's start with a poem. I'll read this a couple times. This is fairly straightforward, but as we have with some of the other poems, I'll give you a chance just to reflect on it in silence, and then I'll ask you what strikes you about this poem. How does it speak to you, if it does? Another one by Denise Levertov. I should say, it's possible I've said this before. I think three of the four poems I've used have been by Denise Levertov, and she has a wonderful little volume called The Stream and the Sapphire. She's written, I mean, lots of poems, but it has many of the poems on religious themes. She converted to Roman Catholicism, and so has some of the poems from before that, kind of leading up to that, and then some of her more confessional poems. And they're just really beautiful. I find them extremely fruitful for meditation, and just the vividness of their insight and image. So hear this poem called Primary Wonder. I'll read it, give you just a moment of silence, read it again, and then we'll have a chance just to see what you make of it, how it strikes you. Primary Wonder by Denise Levertov. Days pass when I forget the mystery. Problems insoluble and problems offering their own ignored solutions jostle for my attention. They crowd its antechamber, along with a host of diversions, my courtiers wearing their colored clothes, caps, and bells. And then, once more the quiet mystery is present to me, the throng's clamor recedes, the mystery that there is anything at all, let alone cosmos, joy, memory, everything rather than void. And that, O Lord, Creator, Hallowed One, you still, hour by hour, sustain it. Just take a minute in the silence to reflect on that poem. What images, phrases stick out to you, strike your attention? I'm going to read it one more time and then we'll share. Listen to it one more time. Days pass when I forget the mystery. Problems insoluble and problems offering their own ignored solutions jostle for my attention. They crowd its antechamber along with a host of diversions, my courtiers wearing their colored clothes, caps, and bells. And then, once more, the quiet mystery is present to me, The throng's clamor recedes. The mystery that there is anything at all, let alone cosmos, joy, memory, everything, rather than void. And that, O Lord, Creator, Hallowed One, you still, hour by hour, sustain it. What in there? Anything strikes you or sticks out to you? Yes?
Yeah, I love how she refers to this mystery. She doesn't try to make a caricature of it, as we often see when people try to make some hard definition. She sort of makes a cloud around. I'm having trouble even describing what appeals to me about it, but it's just something is there. And she recognizes it, and we recognize in her a common awareness.
Right, this common awareness of mystery that she gestures toward, but she doesn't define. Beautiful. Thank you. Anything else strike you in here? Yeah.
So the cyclical inert nature of it.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. So there's this kind of we dive into our problems, and that kind of crowds out awareness of the divine. And then we step back. There's a relaxing sometimes. Or the suggestion here isn't even that we do something. It just reemerges this sense of mystery, of the mystery that there is something at all. Yes?
I agree with Barney and Barb.
All right, he agrees. Yeah?
I did try school English in my junior American Lit class. For the last month, we've been talking about Native American literature. It's kind of so the treatment of indigenous people in this country. We've had slave narratives. Most recently, we're going into Puritan, so the Crucible and the connection to modern day discussion of McCarthyism with the current set of hearings. So, when I saw the idea of the ignored solutions, we had a discussion over the past month with these kids about we've learned these lessons, we've been there, we know these things. Why are Nazi flags showing up in America in 2018? So, that's sort of being educated and being informed and living a positive life today. I guess the same thing we just said in a religious sense. We get caught up in the bells and the versions and what we think we know and how we know best, when there's a foundation of either knowledge that we should have learned from, or a God that we can be still and trust.
Yeah, thank you for that. Something you said about Native Americans and indigenous people reminded me of a conversation I had, I believe perhaps with you, after we were done last time. We talked about how, like, for instance, Native American spirituality, it's bathed in this awareness of connection and the presence of the divine. And then we Westerners have something we call civilization, and we think what we've done through colonialization and civilization is travel the world and with our rationalism and our solutions to problems, right, that is kind of the phrase that would that we might use is desacralized, right? There's this sense of the sacredness of all things, but what civilization does is it desacralizes all of that. But there's this sense at the end that this mystery of divine presence, that there is something, and that it is sustained by God, wants to, almost like lava coming up through fissures in our souls, just doesn't want to be kept down. Right, and sometimes it reemerges. One of the reasons I'm introducing this today is partly because of what Bill said, this alternating. Sometimes we talk about prayer as the conscious awareness of the presence of God, and we think of people who are mystics or people who are contemplatives, there's this continual awareness, dwelling in this awareness. And I sometimes read those people and I long for it, and I realize that this is much more like the experience, that really we're just going about our day. You know, we're getting our groceries. We're making sure that for us, the kid gets picked up at the right time in the right place. We were picking up a kid last night at 10 o'clock from a homecoming dance when the phone rang and he got a ride home with someone else because his phone had died and he could, right? And so he was, right, the problem, soluble and insoluble, right? That's mostly what we do. And the hope is that we are practicing a kind of openness to God that at least makes us available to the emergence of the sense of mystery when it tries to strike us. And there's a way in which that's what we've been talking about. On the first day, 4 weeks ago, I tried to present a picture of prayer as becoming increasingly open, available, and responsive to the transforming presence of Christ in our midst, right? This ongoing availability, openness. It's a part of the picture of in this poem. Even though she's caught up in her mind, sometimes there's still an openness to the mystery when it shows itself. And then we said some of the things that get in the way of that are the way the false self, turned in on itself, clings to attachments and agendas, wants its own way in the world, and that can close us off to our openness and our availability and receptivity to the divine presence, to God, to the Holy Spirit working in our lives. So one of the practices, we said, that can help us open and remain open to God is the practice of becoming aware of and letting go of our agendas and attachments. And then last week we talked about another practice, the practice of having a soul friend, an anamkara, this openness to others and the space that they can create in our lives to be aware of God's presence. Help us continue to let go and be open and available. So today what I want to do is talk about a figure you're likely unfamiliar with. Some of you might know who Thomas Kelly is, but Thomas Kelly, a Quaker mystic and teacher and writer of a little devotional classic called A Testament of Devotion. Because I think his life and his writings pull some of these themes together. And help us see what can they look like in the story of a life. So really what I'm doing is just talking about someone I really like to talk about and trying to make it fit in the theme for this month because I really like to talk about Thomas Kelly. And what it'll end up feeling like is we're just going to look together at a lot of quotations from his writings under certain themes and see how they relate to what we've been talking about for the last few weeks. Now, I remember how old I was when I started reading Thomas Kelly. I was 32 years old, so that was about 11 years ago when I read his book, A Testament of Devotion, for the first time. Have any of you ever heard of this book, except that I mentioned it a month ago? So some of you have. You know, it's been compared with other kind of spiritual classics like Brother Lawrence, Practicing the Presence of God. It's been compared with the 14th century, A Cloud of Unknowing, just a slim devotional volume that gets quickly to the essence of so much of the contemplative Christian spiritual tradition. So coming from using more Quaker language. I remember how old I was because when I was reading the biographical memoir at the beginning by Douglas Steer, I have circled in there 32, what he was doing when he was 32 years old, because I was 32 at the time, then I was interested in what was going on in his life. When I was 32 years old, I had a couple little boys who kept me very busy, and I was the pastor of a rural congregation in North Carolina. And one of the things I distinctly remember at that period of my life was I was attached to the idea that it was my job to make this church succeed as the pastor. It was my job to turn this church around. I was convinced that through my preaching and my pastoral leadership and my winsome and gregarious personality, that I would... Are we awake this morning? That was okay. We're awake. That I would single-handedly, right? Exactly. Silence concurring. That I would turn this church around. And not aside alongside of that, just a year earlier, I'd finished a PhD, and I was determined that somehow, as many 32 years olds are, I was going to make my mark. I didn't know how. I didn't know if it was going to be as a pastor turning a church around or if it was going to be as an academic. But I was driven to succeed. And as you know from last week, I had a spiritual director at this time, not for very long, maybe for a couple of years. And he began to notice this this drivenness in me, this attachment to this image of myself as the one who was going to save this little church. And he very gently suggested that this might not be the most fruitful way to approach not only ministry, but life and relationships in general, that it might not be healthy for me, that it might not be healthy for the flourishing of my congregation. So he said, you might want to read this guy named Thomas Kelly. I sense that you two could have a connection. So the next Saturday, I drove down to this enormous used bookstore in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I bought this slim little volume called A Testament of Devotion. 5 short essays that Thomas Kelly had written very close to the end of his life. Kelly was born in the late 1890s. In Ohio. He was a Midwestern Quaker. He grew up, felt a sense of call to ministry, but also academics. He got his master's degree and then a PhD from Hartford Theological Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. He also had this sense of needing to achieve, this drivenness. He longed not only for academic mastery of his field, which was philosophy and the philosophy of science, and then increasingly the philosophy of religion, but he also longed to make his mark. He not only wanted to succeed, but he wanted to be known for his success, for his achievements. And so here's how, in the biographical introduction, how Douglas Steer summarizes his life. The story of Thomas Kelly's life is a story, I don't think I have this quote, I'll let you know when there's a quote on your sheet. The longer ones from Kelly are on your sheet. The story of Thomas Kelly's life is the story of a passionate and determined quest for adequacy. Just think about that. I mean, that probably characterizes the first half of most of our lives, right? And the second half of a lot of our lives. A passionate and determined quest for adequacy. Well, after he finished his PhD at Hartford, he got a job teaching at Earlham School of Religion in Richmond, Indiana. And one of the challenges of his teaching there was he felt like this Midwestern little Quaker school was narrow-minded. And he remembered being in the kind of rarefied, what he took to be the rarefied academic environments of the East Coast. He'd gone to Haverford College in Philadelphia as an undergraduate and then that PhD in Connecticut, and he longed to be back there. He knew that here in Earlham, he would never amount to anything, right? No one would ever discover him. And so, in this passionate and determined quest for adequacy, Kelly decided that a PhD from Hartford wasn't enough. But if he had a PhD from a real university that would get him recognized, then maybe this would be his path to something greater. So he applied to get a PhD, another PhD, at Harvard University. And he got in at great expense and cost to his family, a great sacrifice. They couldn't afford this. He went back to Harvard. He studied with one of the great philosophers of the day, Alfred North Whitehead, a philosopher of math and a philosopher of religion. And then he finished up his coursework. He even finished his dissertation, and he even published his dissertation with Princeton University Press. But he had not, at this time, defended his dissertation. So he didn't actually have his PhD yet. And he got to this place in 1937 when he went to Harvard in the fall of 1937 to defend his dissertation. And he stood in the lecture hall before the gathered faculty, and he had what's essentially a kind of nervous breakdown. He went blank. He didn't remember his name. He didn't remember where he was. He couldn't speak. And the Harvard faculty wouldn't let him come back and try again. So his door, this door to a PhD from a real university, Harvard, was slammed shut forever. And with it, it seemed to him like his quest for adequacy and recognition, that determined quest to make himself somebody, was shut. And Kelly fell into a deep depression in the fall of 1937. He His wife feared that he might even be suicidal. This whole sense of identity, what made him who he was just immediately robbed from him, and he had nothing else to stand on. But then his friends, his wife, no one really knows what happened. But after about 2.5 months of this, he emerged from this period of darkness, this liminal space. And when you're in a liminal space like that, you can stay there for a long time, but it can go one of two different directions. It can lead towards destruction, but sometimes you can emerge into a new kind of life. And here's how Douglas Steer describes what happened. In the late autumn of 1937, after the publication of his book, a new life direction took place in Thomas Kelly. No one knows exactly what happened, but a strained period in his life was over. He moved toward adequacy. A fissure in him seemed to close. Cliffs caved in and filled a chasm, and what was divided grew together within him. So this extraordinary moment of failure became an opportunity for a kind of healing of his identity, a rediscovery of his personhood, who he truly was. In the language of Richard Rohr, some of you might read Richard Rohr. He had a very popular book a few years ago called Falling Upward. And in that book, he talks about a necessary fall. How sometimes as we move into a deeper sense of a settledness about who we are and our life in God, it requires a necessary fall. That rug of achievement and success and identity be pulled out from under us so we can discover who we truly are. He suffered a necessary fall. And one of the reasons I was drawn to this is because I felt a connection to Kelly when I was reading this story, right? I recognized I hadn't suffered a necessary fall yet, but I recognized this determined quest to achieve adequacy, to succeed, to become somebody. But what Kelly offered me as a young father and a young pastor, a leader of a congregation, was an alternative vision. He offered me a vision of the power of what he would call the living Christ within, the divine light within, that agency within me and within the congregation I served, the only thing that could make me adequate. Not my success, not my achievement, nothing I could do on my own, but this sense of the divine presence within. And this knowledge that it was already working in my congregation, the presence of Christ. So it wasn't my job to make something happen, but it was my job to discern and help this congregation discern what the living Christ was already trying to do and to get in on the act. So you might remember from the first week, we talked about functional atheism. Remember I quoted another Quaker, 20th century Quaker, Parker Palmer, who said functional atheism is the belief that if anything good is going to happen around here, it's up to us to make it happen. This sense that ultimate responsibility for everything rests on us. You remember that? And then he added, and this is particularly prevalent among people who can talk a good game of God, right? So we talk about God, we say we believe in God, but we live and act as if it's all up to us, that God is not an active living agent and presence within our midst. Well, almost 100 years earlier, Kelly diagnosed exactly the same problem in himself and in religious communities. And I think his account of this is continuously relevant to congregations today. So there's a chapter in A Testament of Devotion called The Eternal Now and Social Concern. And in that chapter, he argues at his time, now this is 1938 that he writes this chapter in January, very shortly after he comes out of this dark liminal space. He argues that there's a common assumption that religion or religious experience, in order for it to be valued, must make a positive, tangible, and visible change in the world. So this was a kind of time of a sense of burgeoning social gospel activism. And there was this sense that for any of that to be worthwhile, for religion or religious experience to be worthwhile, you had to be able to see immediately the difference it was making in the world. So he writes, I do think this quote is on your handouts. Many of these will be. There is a tendency in today, in this generation, to suppose that the religious life must prove its worth because it changes the social order. Now, I suspect many of us would actually agree with that, right? This is the religious life should have tangible consequences that we could see in the world. The test of the importance of any supposed dealing with eternity is the benefits it may possibly bring to the affairs in time. It sounds like he's suggesting there's an imbalance between our dealings in time, in the world, our making things happen, getting something done, and our dealings with eternity. And that if you spend too much time thinking about eternity and the divine, you can get lost in that. And if it doesn't make a tangible consequence over here, it's of no value. So there needs to be this balance. But that's really not what he's suggesting. What he's suggesting is that as long as you're beginning still thinking of this balance, the divine, eternal over here, the temporal, the present, the time-bound over here, you're already on the wrong track. Because you see these two things as separate, as divine. You're already dealing in what to people today would call a dualistic imagination. Eternity over here, time over here, and the value of this is judged by whether it can change this. So he goes on to say, we are in an era of this-sidedness, with a passionate anxiety about economics and political organization, and the test of the worthwhileness of any experience of eternity has become, does it change things in time? If so, let us keep it. If not, let us discard it. So there's a utilitarian test as to whether our dealings with eternity matter. Can they change things in time? But what he's suggesting, the problem is that we have failed to see that time, this side, this-sidedness, is always and already infused with eternity. That there isn't this division that we imagine. That we inhabit, this bifurcation between the life of the divine and the life of time. And so that what we end up doing is living in time, our lives in the world, getting along, making a difference, in a very narrow horizon, outside of this vision of time already infused with eternity, right? And this, he thinks, is what would fuel functional atheism. This frenzied need to save the day on our own because we don't see time encompassed and infused and sustained already by eternity. So he thinks this has tangible consequences, and this is what I think matters. Look at how he describes ordinary life when we live in this side, so to speak, cut off from eternity. He says, the ordinary man, and I apologize for his 1937 language here. The ordinary man, busy earning a living, exercises care, caution, foresight. He calculates possibilities. He studies the past in order to predict and control, that's a key word there, control the future. Then when he has weighed all the factors and plotted the outcome, with energy and industry, he wills himself into persistent activity along the lines of calculated wisdom. That's his picture of life cut off from eternity. Calculating, persistent activity, trying to control the future based on the best information possible. A life cut off, lived outside of the horizon of God's agency and activity. But his real concern is how this way of approaching life infiltrates the religious life and the life of what he calls the church worker. So now you can begin to imagine your own or other congregations you've been involved in this next description. And much religious work is carried on in just the same way. With shrewd and canny foresight, religious people study the past, examine all the factors in the situation which they can foresee, then decide what is the wisest to undertake, or what is the most congruent with the Christian life described in the gospel. Then, that's a key word right there, then they breathe a prayer to God to reinforce their wills and keep them strong in executing their resolve. Do you see the order there? Right? We calculate, we look at the past, we determine the future, we decide what we want to do, and then we breathe a prayer asking God to reinforce our wills and give us resolve to continue. Now, I think, because I've hung around churches a little while, I think that this is a fairly accurate description of the way we go about business in the church. I mean, this is very much like what a typical business meeting can look like in a congregation. We meet to discuss, it's the finance committee, and we're getting ready for our stewardship campaign. What the theme is going to be, how we're going to do it, how this year we're going to convince more people to give just a little bit more money than they did last year. And the chair of the meeting begins the meeting, and then someone says, oh, you know, really, we should pray. We should have a devotion. We should ask. So someone says, yeah, could you go out in the hallway and get God, who's sitting on a bench out in the hallway, and invite God in here for just a few seconds? And then so we invite God in, and we say, God, we're about to have a meeting. We want you to bless what we're about to do. We want to do what we do in your name. But we also want to get through this meeting kind of quickly. So if you wouldn't mind just sitting back out in the hall until we're done. And then we go about our business, and then we're eager to get home. We've made a few decisions, and then someone says, oh, you know, really, we should ask God to bless what we... Ah, that's right. So go back out in the hallway, invite God back in. God, we've made a bunch of decisions in your name, and we'd ask that you would bless our decisions and give us kind of courage and strength to make them successful. But do it quickly because we want to get home and go to bed. Right? Have you been to that meeting? I mean, I don't know. I don't know this church. So, you know, I've been to that meeting at a number of different places. I'm at that meeting at the seminary quite a lot. And I've been at it in different congregations. So you can see this bifurcation, right? Eternity and time. And this is where we work and make something happen, and it's up to us. So here are some phrases. These are not on your handout. But here are some phrases that he uses to describe life in congregations. And I just think some of these are so telling. He talks about the active, hurrying church worker, the fevered life of the church worker. He talks about the anxious, careful planner of shrewd moves. He says we believe that we are the energetic operators of religion, which gives rise to the fevered effort of the self-sufficient religionist. We got to hang out with that one a little bit. The fevered effort of the self-sufficient religionist. We follow rationally planned decisions, and then our lives become framed and strained and frantic. He's suggesting that we work even in the church in a functionally atheistic way, that our effort is self-originated, that it comes from us. It begins and ends in us. And it would be worth pausing, not necessarily to have a conversation, but just to reflect. Do those phrases describe in any way your life? Do they ring a bell? Nah. Do they ring a bell? Do they strike a chord, the frantic life of the church, of the church worker? This fevered effort to make something happen. Do they describe the life of your congregation or congregations you've been a part of? Because he adds, he says this kind of calculating existence in individuals and communities keeps us, this isn't his word, but it's an appropriate word, we lose a sense of vocation. When we're frantically working in this kind of way, we forget who we are, why we're here. We get distracted by a million good tasks. And I think when he talks about this, he must have Martha and Mary in Luke chapter 11 in mind. Martha, who is distracted by her many tasks. She's not criticized because she's working hard, right? She's criticized because she's distracted by her many tasks. And you know what that word tasks in Greek is? It comes from the Greek word diakonia, which means ministries. She's distracted by her many ministries. Right? Now, I think that's a beautiful description of many congregations. So busy, such a long list of things that we do and have been doing for 30 years on the back of the bulletin, that we begin to forget, where's the center in this? What is our true vocation? Why are we really here? So Kelly writes, we get distracted by the intellectual claims to our interest in 1,001 good things, and before we know it, we are pulled and hauled breathlessly along by an overburdened program of good commitments and good undertakings. Pulled and hauled breathlessly along by an overburdened commitment of good undertakings. And then he adds, I think with a little bit of understatement, I am persuaded that this fevered life of the church workers is not wholesome. It's not wholesome. Overburdened. So he has this, I think he's writing autobiographically here. He's writing out of that early, the first half of his life, where he himself is driven. And he's driven as he's leading congregations. He's driven to become something. But then this experience, what I've called his liminal experience, or what Rohr would call his necessary fall, it was a rather sudden reorientation, an extraordinary shift in how he approaches life, his life, and the life of faith. And so later, about 6 months later after this happens, Kelly is in Germany in 1938 to give a prestigious Quaker lecture. And he works very hard on it. And while he's there, he's writing letters back home to his wife, Lael. So these letters are in the archives of Haverford College, and you can read his descriptions of what's going on in Germany at the time, which are really quite interesting. But then there's also this beautiful section of a letter he writes to his wife. And I have it on here, and I'd love to read it through with you and just see what you notice, how this is so different from the way he's just been describing his earlier life. I believe it begins this summer in Germany. Do you see that? That paragraph? Yes, it's on the bottom of page 2. This summer in Germany has opened up what was already opening up before, a new sense of unreserved dedication of oneself to a life of childlike dedication to God. Last winter, you know, I was much shaken by the experience of presence, something I did not seek but that sought me. And the work here this summer, or in the midst of the work here this summer, has come an increased sense of being laid hold on by a power, a gentle, loving, but awful power. And it makes one know the reality of God at work in the world. And it takes away the old self-seeking, self-centered self, from which selfishness I have laid heavy burdens on you, dear one. I see my way now to a richer life of serenity and a childlike faith and joy. Just take a minute to reread that confessional paragraph he writes to his wife one more time. And I'm just curious what you notice about that seems so different from the way over the past 4 weeks I've been describing the false self and functional atheism and this way we can function to secure our own lives and identities in the world. Just read through that yourself. I'm curious what stands out to you. What do you notice there? What are some, anything stick out to you in that brief paragraph? Bill?
You know, I think what you've been talking about here is this notion of time in the brain, or a time horizon is the way we think about time.
Mm-hmm.
And the word that jumped out at me here is childlike.
Mm.
Children mind to drive to
hospitals. Yeah. Yeah. This twice he mentions that childlike, right? That's one of the phrases in here that I actually hadn't spent much time thinking about it, but I think you're exactly right. A child doesn't yet have the capacity to live in the divide, right? My spiritual, religious, eternal, the temporal where I work hard and make something happen. But there's this sense of rediscovering the unity and the, you know, I'm thinking about the poem we began with, primary wonder. That would almost, you know, childlike wonder in the mystery. And as you grow older, you know, it comes and it goes, and you begin to develop this rational way of approaching life, and it squeezes out the primary wonder, and he's rediscovering that childlike wonder. Thank you for that. Yes.
It sounds like you have a particular experience that turns his whole life upside down.
Mm-hmm. He said it sounds like he had a mystical experience that turned his whole life upside down. And I think that's a beautiful way to put it. I'm just curious, in the paragraph, what makes you, when you read it, what makes you think, he's having a mystical experience here?
He experienced the presence.
Okay, the presence of the divine.
He can't name it.
Right.
So all his theology means
nothing. Mm-hmm.
Because it can't define this mystery.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's real.
It's real.
And everything he thought before was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He has to rethink everything.
Mm-hmm. It's completely transforming.
Absolutely.
Right. This encounter with presence. Yeah. Yes. And then here. Yeah.
But even last week when you talked about the monastic, you know, going out into the desert, getting away from all of that, and, you know, I think there's a role to some of that organization and authority.
Mm-hmm.
We're all together because there is some organization and authority that
right.
just happened upon here, but that knowledge and that memory of the mystic and the eternity and that balance.
Right. There's a reconnection going on, right? And you're exactly right to name that we couldn't get along without what's being criticized here as taking over. So that's the challenge, right? As taking over as if it's the only game in town, right? The calculating, rational planning. I mean, you couldn't get your groceries from the grocery store without that part of your life. You couldn't. Right, it's a necessary part, but he's talking about the way it takes over and crowns itself, right, and then pushes out any other possibility. And it's what we saw in that poem, and it's what's going on here in his life as well. Great, thank you. Yeah. Oh, you know, I'm sorry, actually. That's a typo. It's 38. Yes. So he hasn't... Exactly, right. No, well, he did have foretastes, but he, in the mid-30s, he'll write in some lectures about how you can... He talks about... He has a lecture called The Mystic's Experience. He talks about mild mystical experiences and acute mystical experiences. And when he writes about the mild mystical experiences, this is in 1934, he suggests that you get the feeling that he knows something about this, the mild mystical experience. He talks about the way an experience of nature. This is why I think it's autobiographical, because he says the beauty of a mathematical equation. And I thought, well, that's not a common one, right, to elicit a mild mystical experience. But when he gets to the acute mystical experience, it doesn't sound autobiographical at all. It feels like he's talking, as I do when I talk about the mystics. I'm talking about someone else's experience. You read about it, you learn as best you can, right? But you're describing someone else's experience. And so he did have kind of hints of it, but not in this dramatic way. And then now he's clearly writing out of authenticity. Right, this is me. I'm not living secondhand from what I've read about the mystics, but this is my experience. Yeah.
That's almost a shame because I saw that and the misinterpretation of things is that's how much life really is. Mm-hmm. We have the experiences, being that presence, and then we have to back to being, the human doing.
Right.
Human being.
Right.
And you mentioned. Necessarily fill that role. In reading like Hilbert, mm-hmm. She still had to be the
us. Exactly.
She still had to be in there. That
right.
She at the beginning, there were times when we called
me
this, times
when we called me this. Uh-huh. Exactly, this sense of alternating, this alternating vision. And so that's why, one of the reasons I'm interested in Kelly is because the way his life story is told, usually it's all like there's this dramatic change and everything is different. But you see hints leading up to this change where he has mystical experiences that kind of are a foretaste of this. And afterwards, you still see that little bit of ego pop up in his letter. It's not like it's suddenly extinguished, but there is a dramatic shift. But there's also this back and forth as well. Yeah. Anybody else notice anything in here?
A problem with ego isn't always that we think too highly of ourselves, but we think of ourselves too often.
Mm-hmm.
And his sentence about that, the number of times he uses the word self, the old self-seeking, self-centered self from which selfishness, I have laid heavy burdens on you.
Uh-huh.
It's just too frequently, that sense of, I'm all about that.
Yeah.
And it's my purpose, it's my...
Yes.
It's my motivation, it's my...
Yeah.
Passion, it's my end game.
Yeah. And I just think I think one of the things I love about this is the confessional. I mean, he knows that his, for instance, wanting to get another PhD was a great financial strain to his family. And then he put his whole family under the strain for his own, that false self, right? That center of gravity. His whole life was the center of gravity. And he's beginning to wake up to that reality and recognize what he went through. Yeah. One of the things that I find interesting about this passage is one of the ways of talking about the mystical journey. There are lots of ways to talk about it. One of the most classic ways is to talk about that threefold movement from purgation, illumination, and union. And purgation is kind of what we were talking about with attachments, that work of God to let go, to free us from our agendas, the things we're attached to. Because what do? They blind us. Our attachments blind us to the good and the true and the beautiful, what's really going on in the world. And as soon as we begin to be freed from those attachments, probably not completely, but enough, we begin to see more clearly. We can begin to understand how God is at work. We have a new vision of reality. And that moves us eventually perhaps to that place where we sense or feel or realize that we are united with God. Right? So that's a kind of a classic mystical journey. And I think you can see, at least in here, elements of the first two. When he says that the power, the gentle power, takes away the old self-seeking, this line you just read, self-centered self from which selfishness, right? It takes that away. He's being, in a sense, purged. This experience is purging him of that self-centeredness. And then so earlier he says, and it makes one know the reality of God at work in the world. So having been purged or being purged of his attachments to himself, he's able now to see more clearly the reality of God at work in the world, right? It's not all him at work in the world anymore, the reality of God. So he has a clearer sense of vision about. Now, then maybe there's a hint that he's moving towards this sense of being united with God as well. One of the things I think I talked about the very first week with regard to spiritual practices and disciplines. We talked about moving to spirituality in the passive voice, right? That our spiritual disciplines aren't about what we do to achieve our relationship with God, but they're things that we bring up in our lives that we participate in order to open us to God's agency in our lives. And I noticed this in here too. He's moved, his relationship with God is now in the passive voice. He says, I was shaken. something I did not seek, but it sought me. I was laid hold on by a power. Right? So this isn't something that he didn't wake up one day and say, I need to have a mystical relationship with God, and I'm going to, you know, read the book Seven Steps to Mystical Union with God and put those steps into my life, you know. Seven Habits of Highly Effective Mystics. No, right? He did not seek this, but it sought him. And this reminds me of a quotation from Gerald May, who is a psychiatrist and spiritual director, who writes, "When the spiritual life feels so uprooted, it can be almost impossible to believe or even consider." Surely I didn't forget to put this on your... Oh, no, it's there. Yes. "It's almost impossible to believe or even consider that what's really going on is a graceful process of liberation, a letting go of old limiting habits to make room for a fresh openness to love." I think that's a beautiful description of what happened to him in his reorientation. The divine presence, what felt like a painful fall to him, was a period in which God freed him from, or began to free him from, old limiting habits to make room for a fresh openness to love. And I believe that's both his God's love for him, a fresh openness to the fact that we are loved, but also a fresh openness to loving in the world, to loving in the world. So I want to skip some of the next 3 points, because that's kind of more theological about his, you know, God the initiator and the living Christ within, and how in his new vision our agency, our activity is no longer one side or the other, but it is already participation in God's life. God now is infusing our lives from his perspective. But I want to just say a couple things about his more practical approach to prayer and to this classic Quaker idea of a concern. So we're skipping ahead a little bit. He believes prayer can become something like constant communion with God. And so this gets right to what we've been talking about. He says the mind works on two different levels. You have the thinking, rational, calculating, get things done level. It's the mind I needed to get from 622 Orchard Hill Drive this morning in O'Hara Township to Upper St. Clair, right? I had to use that mind. But he says also that we have a deeper level. I think this is what many of the Christian traditions would call soul. It's what Eastern Orthodoxy would call heart, the center of the human being, this deeper place where we are in touch with God. And he says this is where the real action is at. And part of what prayer is at first it's learning to kind of switch between, okay, I'm using this part of my mind, but then I'm creating space to be in touch with this deeper reality. And so he says that we can use breath prayers in Eastern Orthodoxy. They use the Jesus prayer. But that we can have an inner orientation toward God, worship, praising God, giving thanks, have this communion with God at a very deep level, right? And at the beginning, he says we have to practice that. You know, we have to be intentional about it. It doesn't come naturally. You know, and it feels like this alternating back and forth. Now I'm thinking, now I'm working, but now I'm taking some time to be with God and to pray in an intentional kind of way. But he says that we can get to a place, and this is consistent with, for instance, the Eastern Orthodox tradition of saying the Jesus prayer. That we can get to a place where we can go about, we can function in our daily lives, so we don't have to turn off that aspect of who we are. And yet, deep within us, there can be this inner ongoing communion with God. That we can get beyond alternating, and that we can live in this constant awareness of and orientation to God. But I love the way he says we get to that. He says, mental habits of inward orientation must be established. Remember, we talked the very first week about spiritual disciplines and about how part of it is our just showing up. They are something we do, even though we do them to be open to God. There's something we do. Mental habits of inward orientation must be established. An inner secret turning to God can be made fairly steady. Here's the key line. After weeks and months and years of practice and lapses and failures and return. Right? So this is not a glib, you know, you can wake up tomorrow and be in constant prayer to God. But this is why I think, one of the reasons I think Thomas Kelly is the real deal, because he acknowledges and he's gentle with failure. Right? After weeks and months and years and lapses and failures and returns, and he says, all you do is you notice I'm now caught up in myself. I have moved myself back to the center again in this life. Well, just start over. Turn to God. Say those breath prayers again. Re-enter that place of centeredness. Don't blame yourself. Don't say, I knew you couldn't do it. You're a failure. You'll never be able to pray. You might as well just give this whole thing up. No. Weeks and months and years of lapses and failures. Here's the other reason I think he's the real deal. I think the next quotation, I love this. You got to remember, he's a man writing in 1940, okay, when you read this. Do you want to live in such an amazing divine presence that life is transformed into peace and power and glory and miracle? If you do, then you can. But if you say you haven't the time to go into the recreating silences, I can only say then you don't really want to. For, except for spells of sickness in the family and when the children are small, when terrific pressure comes upon us, we find the time for what we really want to do. Don't you love that? I mean, I didn't know in the 19... I mean, he at least knew his children were small ones, and it's hard to pray when the kids are little. Yes?
The word that jumps out to me is miracle, because in that state, you recognize miracles that you would never see.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's that openness to illumination, right? You begin to see the activity of the divine in your life, and you've never seen it. You've never seen it before. But then he goes on to say, but I confess, it doesn't take time or complicate your program. I find that a life of little whispered words of adoration, of praise, of prayer, of worship can be breathed all through the day. One can have a very busy day outwardly speaking and yet be steadily in the holy presence. And that's the articulation of that union, right? Hildegard is the abbess. Potentially still could be in that sense of divine presence, right? We need a half an hour or so of quiet reading and relaxation, but I find that one can carry the recreating silences within oneself well nigh all the time. Well, I suspect that is not the experience of most of us, and it's certainly not my own experience. But I'm thinking about where we began. As prayer, these disciplines, these things we engage in, that half an hour of reading in the morning, the examine in the evening, fasting in Lent, these things that we do because we want to be open to the divine presence, because we want to know spirituality in the passive voice, we want to allow the agency of God to be at work in our lives, and we want to respond. That's where we began. And here where we end is not really in a different place at all. It's that same place where we show up, we open ourselves to the divine presence. We allow ourselves to be done unto, rather than being the one in the center who's doing the doing. And what Kelly gives us is a picture of what's possible. Not esoteric, mystical experiences on a high mountain, not moving out into the desert because that's the only place we can really meet God. But here in the busyness of everyday life, the possibility that we can be in sustained awareness of the presence of God in our lives, and that it can open our eyes to a deeper awareness of who we are and who our neighbor is and how the love of God is permeating all that is. So we've kind of come full circle to that picture. And I know there's more tantalizing quotes on your handout, and you'll have no idea what they're about, but you can read them and enjoy them anyway. So friends, this has been a great delight to be with you for another 4 weeks, and I hope we get to do this again sometime. But thank you for showing up, and especially for your attention and participation. I appreciate that. Enjoy the rest of your day.